you all for coming again to the fourth installment of the Kukla Zakam Shir. So just to summarize what we've seen up until now, because today we're really going to bring things to like a very practical semi-conclusion. So basically what we've seen is that we started out with the Midrashim, Midrashim Halacha, and we saw a different range of opinions. If really anything non-Jews do, we can't copy. Only things that are limited to Avodah Zarah, things that are immoral, things that are institutionalized. We saw a number of different options. The Gemaras themselves were a bit unclear. Some Gemaras imply that, once again, anything non-Jews do, we can't do. So, for example, the Gemara about decapitation. Because the Roman government decapitates people with a sword, it should be also for us to do, unless we find an explicit biblical source. And the other Gemara sounded like, you know, the things non-Jews do is fine for us to copy, as long as there is some type of reason involved. Last week, we saw the Rambam and the Maverick. The Rambam sounded like, once again, anything non-Jews do is also for us to copy. We're trying to create a distinct, different type of culture. And the Maverick limited the Kukla Zakam to two categories. Number one, things that are strange, things that don't have any logical basis, to the degree that if you look at the person doing them, you're sort of mystified, stupefied as to why he's doing it. That's category number one. And category number two are things that have a nindud pritzos, things that are working in the direction of breaking down one of society's moral barriers, moral boundaries. And that's what we have. That's sort of what we have up until now, from the Midrashim down to the Gemaras, down to the Rishonim. And today we'll see the Torah and Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, and we'll see how we paskin, and we'll see one or two contemporary issues as to how the poskim dealt with the earlier sources and ruled accordingly. So great. So let's start off with the Torah. The Torah is the first comprehensive book of Jewish law written after the Rambam. And he says as follows. Asur l'lefes b'kuklos ovdei kohanim. Great. You can't walk in their ways, and you definitely can't do magic. Skip down to the bolded part. Elafilu minag shenagu asur v'lichbo. It's asur even to follow a random custom that they do. D'ksiv b'kuklosayim lo silichu. Chin kasav Rambam. Ein hochken b'kuklos ovdei kohanim. V'lo medamin lahem. V'lo b'malbush, v'lo b'sear, v'chayotzi b'hen. Ela yiyah Yisrael muzal mehem. So who does the Torah quote out of all the various opinions you could have quoted? The Rambam. Sounds like he's being super firm. Sounds like he's saying that just that exactly what the Rambam sounds like. If non-Jews who have a certain fashion, it's usur for Jews to follow that fashion. By just looking at a Jew, you should know that he's different just based on the clothing that he wears. And then he goes into hairstyles. You shouldn't copy or imitate non-Jewish hairstyles. Great. So the Torah seems like he's being machmir. The Beis Yosef, who is the Rabbi Yosef Karo's commentary on the Torah, he sort of fills you in as to where the Torah is getting his sources from. So the Beis Yosef on the Torah quotes Asr Lechas V'Kukos Agayim, quotes the various sources in the Chazal. And he says, V'Kin Kasaf Rambam. He notes that the Torah is quoting the Rambam. But then, luckily for us, he does one more thing. Let's read to the end of that line. The kasa of Marie Cologne, the Marik, Shorosh Pichas, the Ein Le'asor, Mishum Chok, Ela Be'achad Bishnei Chalakim. Then he quotes the entire tshuva of the Marik. That, granted, the Torah might be quoting the Rambam, which sounds like everything is Asur, but don't worry, the Marik says there are only two categories of things that are Asur, things that are completely strange, or things that have a nindud pritzos. Great. So now we get to the Shulchan Aruch. And we get to see how the Shulchan Aruch passes. Elchanan, you want to read the Shulchan Aruch class, please?
Sure.
That's great. Thank you.
Ein hochin mechukos of the kochavim lo midam lahem lo libosh malbush amyutah lahem legdal tzitzit rosho lo tzitzit rosho legalech netzadin v'niach ha-seyar v'amtzav legalech ha-seyar v'anav v'ozim l'ozim v'niach ha-per לא יבנה מקומות כבניין נחלות בשל עובדי כוכבים כדי שיכנסו בהם רבים כמו שהם עושים.
So how would you think a Shulchan Aruch paskin based on what's presented?
Like the Torah.
Sounds like the Torah. Sounds like he's being machmir. Sounds like anything non-Jews do is also for Jews to copy. We have to remain culturally distinct and visibly distinct. The Ramah, the Haggah, who's the Ashkenazi posek, has a very large comment here. So here's what the Rama says. Haga'ah, Eli hei muvda mehan b'mamushav u'bashar ma'asav. So he finishes the quote. He's like, don't think I don't know where you're getting this from. And he concludes the quote, the Jews should be different. Then he qualifies the entire halacha. V'chol zeh inu asur, ela v'davar sh'nagu b'av obdi kochavim l'shem t'chus. He quotes the Marek, don't worry. Everything we just told you, the entire blanket statement of the Rambam has to be qualified with the two qualifications of the Marek. Number one, it's only asur if they're doing it the shame pritzos. And he gives you an example. Like wearing brightly colored clothing in a certain type of society is a sign of haughtiness. That's a certain type of clothing that's asur. Something to just do. And there's no reason for it. Great. That's what the Maverick says.
You know, kind of. I just want to know what's the definition of pritzus here.
So, if you look back in the Shuvah of the Maverick, he first uses the word pritzus, then he later interchanges it with the words shachatz v'gava, which means like haughtiness or showiness. Mm-hmm. So, it may not be something. It may not be only something that's not sinua, meaning covering entire hands or sleeves or things of that sort. It might just be like a certain style or fashionable type of clothing that's supposed to be showy. Great. So those are the two things that Marek says. Number one, something that's a shame pritzus. Number two, something that has no apparent reason. But if you recall correctly, last week, Marek stopped over there. He said anything that doesn't have a reason is going to be asar. And he said, because if you're doing something that doesn't have a reason, and non-Jews do it, it seems like you're just doing it for the sake of imitation. The Rama seems to have a different, slightly different take. Why is it asur to do something that has no apparent reason? Let's continue the quote. De'ika l'meikash bei mishum darki yamori. M'shi'ish vol shemetz avodas kochav ve'nabos seyem. Because if something doesn't have any reason whatsoever, if all of a sudden non-Jews start walking around with clown noses all day, we have to be choshesh, we have to suspect that maybe the sources of that custom are idolatry, are pagan rites. And it seems like, according to the Rama, the issue of following things without a reason is not following for the sake of following. We just don't want you to imitate non-Jews. It's because if something doesn't have an apparent reason, we have to suspect that maybe back in the good old days, it has its sources and idolatrous practices. And this might, these two different ways of reading the Marek, number one, following them for the sake of following them is problematic, and number two, anything that doesn't have an apparent reason might be sourced in idolatry, and that's why it's problematic, might be an important distinction as to when you're trying to figure out questions. Let's say there's something that doesn't have any apparent reason. Let's say all of a sudden, Every non-Jew in Washington Heights started putting on clown noses. So, A, the world would probably be a better place. People would laugh more. I have a friend. It was the funniest thing in the world. I was in the middle of talking with him about a sugya in the Beis Medrash. All of a sudden, in the middle of our discussion, he took out a clown nose, put it on, and continued as if nothing happened. You probably know who I'm talking about. Maybe. Alex Ozer? I'm sorry if it's on tape. But he, by definition, he won the debate. There's no way I could argue with that. But if everybody did that, the world would definitely be a better place. But that's something that has no apparent reason. Let's assume, whatever. There might be a reason, comic humor, whatever it is. But let's assume that's something that's stupefying. People are mystified by it, there's no apparent reason. But on the other hand, something that originates in America in the year 2011, and we could trace it, we know it started at a certain date, presumably it doesn't have pagan sources. It doesn't have idolatrous sources. So if you read the Marek just with the Marek, then it might be usur to where the clown nose is, because you're following them just for the sake of following them, because there's no other apparent reason. But if the issue with the Marek is that if there's no reason, we have to be choshesh, and maybe it has sources in Avodah Zarah, so then something which we know for sure doesn't have sources in Avodah Zarah might very well be mutter, and that might become very important later on. And you might be able to think of a flip case as well. Let's say something, but you're not following them just for the sake of following them. Something might have a good reason. Something might be somewhat logical. But let's say we took it from slightly idolatrous practices. back in the good old days, back 1,000, 1,500 years ago, pagans did this. It trickled down somehow or other in some form to in modern society, and nowadays people do it for a completely different reason. So there is a reason why we're doing it. We're not following them just for the sake of following them. But on the other hand, there is some source in idolatrous pagan practices. And we're going to see that this thing becomes a major issue. Yeah, David?
If something has a reason, so if it has a positive reason, then it's okay, even if it may have been associated with the Bozara.
So that's exactly going to be the machlokas. It sounds like the Rama is going to be osir that. Is anything that has, he contrasts something that's l'tu'elas with something that's for avodah zarah. Meaning the assumption is, if something doesn't have a reason, we have to be koshi just for avodah zarah.
Yes, so
then so presumably it would still be osir, because it has the avodah zarah element there. If you just read the Ma'arik and you didn't notice the words of avodah zarah there, because they aren't there, and then the issue would be following for the sake of following, so then if something has a reason, it was going to be okay.
Right.
But only if you, once you put a avodah zarah there, might it be asur, even if there is going to be a reason. And we'll see, this will have very contemporary ramifications. Great. And then you quote the example, the initial example of the Ma'arik about wearing doctor's coats. Wearing doctor's coats is something that's not stupefying, not mystifying, doesn't have idolatrous roots, something that's there for a good reason, and therefore it's going to be mutter. Because you want to identify who a doctor is. Great. So what do we have so far? So we have the tour quoting the Rambam. We have the Beis Yosef, Yosef Karo, quoting the Ma'arik. Then we have the Shulchan Aruch, the same person, just quoting the Rambam. Again, seemingly the more machmir version. And then we have the Rama, the Ashkenazi posek, qualifying things and limiting things with the limits of the Ma'arik and mentioning avodah zarah. And then the last thing we just have to see before we start analyzing the various cases is the Gra, the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon is very terse, especially in Shulchan Aruch. Usually his comments are usually just a line or two. Here he has a bit of a longer comment, but he very succinctly summarizes it at the very end, at the fourth source on the next page. V'divi Ma'arik ina nirin klal. I think the Ma'arik is wrong. Meaning, he quotes the Rambam, he quotes the more machmir version, that anything that non-Jews do cannot be copied. His proof is the Gemara Sanhedrin about decapitation. He says, if you take that Gemara literally, it sounds like Roman government decapitates people with a sword. It's us, therefore, it should be also for us to do that as well. There's no avodah zarah, no immorality. There is a good reason. It's the cleanest, quickest way of doing it. And still, the Gemara assumes it should be chukas hakam. And therefore, he takes the Gemara straight. That's his main Gemara, and therefore, everything is going to be aser. We might have to draw the line for the Gemara. Meaning, it's not going to say non-Jews use toothpaste, and therefore, Jews can't use toothpaste. We have to draw the line somewhere. But something that is mainly or originates in the non-Jewish community, for a non-Jewish community, is going to be off-limits for Jews. And we discussed in the previous Shurim how other Rishonim might read that Gemara Sanhedrin differently, and might be able to get around that proof. So in terms of psak, if you're an Ashkenazi, I think everybody here is an Ashkenazi except for Yosef Kanti. Great. So if you're Ashkenazi, it basically boils down to a machlokas between the Rama and the Gra. And that's, if you look through all the postgame, that's the way they present it. According to the Rama, there's going to be a very limited scope of things that fall under chukas hakam. According to the Vilna Gaon, it's going to be a very expanded group of things. In general, most Ashkenazim follow the Rama over the Gra, but there are certain communities, certain schools, certain families that were Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, or Talmidim of his Talmidim, and therefore they always follow his practices. So for those families, for those communities, nowadays it's probably more families and communities, you're going to trip over Chukas Hakam much more frequently than your regular Ashkenazi Jew. You learn. Question is, let's say you're a Sephardi. So if all you had in front of you was a Shulchan Aruch, then it seems like you're in the same boat as the Vilna Gaon, as the Gra. Basically, anything non-Jews do is going to be Agdur. It's going to be very problematic for you to go to the store and buy the newest fashion, because Jews should be distinct b'mabusham, as the Vilna Gaon and the Rambam say. So what is the standard Sfardi Psak in contemporary times? Great. So who do we look to? Greatest rabbi of all time? Rabbi Avadia, obviously. So Rabbi Avadia dealt with every possible shayla that's come up in modern times, and he has a number of tshuvos about Chukos HaKom. So this tshuva, I think it's the first one he wrote on the topic, because it just goes through the entire sugya. Like source after source after source after source after source, just goes through the entire thing, and comes up with the psak in the end. So we're going to go through it less for the conceptual understandings, and more just to see how everybody paskins. Because the Shulchan Aruch sounds like we should be very, very machmir. The question was the following. Nish'alti. Is mutter l'seis zar prachim ala arano shahamis? Is it mutter to put a crown of flowers on a funeral casket, on a coffin? Oyish pazem mishum v'kukosem l'osileko. Could you put a wreath of flowers, one of those circle things, they're just stam flowers, to sprinkle them over a grave or over a casket? That's what non-Jews do on their graves, at their funerals. Throwing flowers on a grave apparently was a non-Jewish custom. It's not mentioned in the Gemara's of Shulchan Aruch. Jews started doing it at some point. Is this an issue of Chukos HaKom or is it not? So you go through the sugya. We could just go through the bolded parts. Umarana Beit Yosef. He goes through the sugya, the Gemaras. He says the Beit Yosef quotes this marek. Shein la'asor mishum v'kukosem v'osileku ela be'achad v'izin yonem. There are two categories for Chukos HaKom. And he goes along. He goes down and tells you the categories. And he deals with the sugya. Well, we might get back to these parts in a second. Let's skip for a second to Os Hei. On the next page. Yossi, if you want to read it, just to get the story back. The underlined parts.
L'inyan halakha nir'eh shehuil umaran habet yosef hevidav divrei mahari kolon lehalakha. V'chein hi dad haran har Ribash, Lachin Pascua Haram Haramah, who Mahari, Behagotehem, the Nere Shekin Ikar Ladino.
This is great. So, who is the single person that the single book that Rav Avadia doesn't quote?
Shulchan Aruch.
Meaning, he notes that the Beis Yosef quotes Marek. He notes that the Ramah, the Ran, the Ribash, all paskin that, like the Marek, that only a limited number of cases are under the prohibition of Chukos HaKom, and he paskins like them. Meaning, it sounds like he thinks, since the Beis Yosef quoted the Marek in his commentary on the Torah, even though he doesn't quote it in Shulchan Aruch, that's probably how he paskins. And therefore, he prefers to quote the Beis Yosef, where the Marek is explicit, not the Shulchan Aruch, where the Marek is not mentioned. And because all these other Ashkenazi poskim are paskining like the Ramah and the Marek, we could follow that practice as well. And he says, it's not only because of that. It's not only because Beis Yosef quotes the Marek and the Ramah and all these poskim paskin that way. It's also because if you go through the sugya, you realize that there are certain shitos that just limit Chukos HaKom entirely. In Ozayin, he quotes the opinion of the Uraim. I think we concluded the shiur with last week. It says Chukos HaKom is limited to the actual nations mentioned in the Pasuk. Again, the Pasukim mention the nations of Mitzrayim, the nations of Canaan. Most Rishonim assume those are indicative of nations in general, non-Jewish nations. The Sefer Yoyim, and the late Ashkenazi Rishon, says no. It's only the practices of the customs of the Egyptians and of the seven Canaanite nations. So the Rav Avadia says, great. Anyway, most poskim paskim like the Marek. That's limited. Beis Yosef quotes the Marek. And we have these opinions in the early Rishonim, in earlier times, which don't get quoted in Shulchan Aruch, but they're out there. And they say Chukos Achol is super limited. It's limited dafka to the seven nations of Canaan and Mitzrayim. So therefore, we have enough shitos on our side to paskin l'kula, that anything that's A, not stupefying or mystifying, or B, has some sort of reason, and or is not connected to Avodah Zarah, is going to be mutter. And therefore he says, he thinks it's perfectly fine to sprinkle flowers, or wreaths of flowers, at funerals and on caskets, even though it's clear that the custom originated with non-Jews. And what's interesting about it is that he quotes Sfardi Poskim, who disagreed with him. He quotes the Shud Yaskalavdi of Rav Yosef of Avadia Hadaya, who I think was of Rosh Hashiva and Parat Yosef, which is a big Sfardi yeshiva next to the Kotel, which is a cool place. I never actually went inside. Were you ever inside Yosef? Parat Yosef? It's a place with like a lot of windows if you're there. If you're face away from the Kotel. So he was Rosh Hashiva there, and he passed in the Chumra. He said, look, it's definitely originated with non-Jews. He says, worse, it originated with Europeans. It's not something which people in Sephardic countries are doing at all. And therefore, it should be a violation of Chuppas Nakam. And Ravadi says, no, Ravadi Paskin is Lakula. And that, I assume, most Sephardi people Paskin like Ravadi nowadays. So that's the way these things work. So it seems like the mainstream Ashkenazi Psak and also the mainstream Sephardi Psak is like the Marik. And again, only those two categories of things. Just one more issue, which Ravadi deals with in this particular tshuva, which would depend on this machlokas, is the issue of Israeli military funerals. Let's just read the bolded parts on the next page. Oh, he doesn't even actually mention what the question is, just in parentheses. So what do Israelis do at military funerals? I don't really know. But it sounds like whatever they do was taken from regular Western armies. Meaning, I guess they have the lines of soldiers there with their guns, maybe they shoot them in the air. They do whatever they do. Israeli military funerals were imitations of regular Western armies military funerals. And Rav Zsolti, who was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, I think in the 60s and 70s, wrote an article where he said, this is crazy. This is Chukos Nakam. We finally have a Jewish army. We finally have a Jewish state, a Jewish army. We could follow our own Jewish way of doing things. And what do? We start copying the non-Jews as to the military ceremonies and military funerals. And it's not only this particular issue. There are some poskim who are against the whole, every military ceremony, the whole hashpa'ah. When a soldier enters the army, they have this whole ceremony, they get there together, and they all swear their allegiance to the army. Or, let's say, the sirens on Yom HaZikaron. They confess the sirens throughout the country, and sirens are a symbol where people, or an indication, people should stand up and be silent and give their respects to the fallen soldiers. So again, there's no mention of that in Jewish sources. It's not a Jewish custom. In fact, you have a siren to indicate, to promote silence and honor the fallen, is something that was taken from Western countries. So all these military issues, military ceremonies, military funerals, were hot-button issues at the beginning of the Jewish state. And Rav Zsolti, chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, who wasn't an unimportant figure, wrote a tshuva saying these things are awesome. But what's interesting, if you go through the tshuva, Rav Zsolti admits that according to the Ramah, it should be mutter. Because, again, why are they doing these military funerals? They aren't doing them because of pagan sources. They aren't doing them for no apparent reason. They have soldiers line up and they carry the casket through. They have their guns raised and shoot bullets into the air. That's what they do. Because these are all ways of showing honor to the fallen soldier. You want to show him the highest levels of dignity and honor when you bring him to his final rest. So these things aren't random. They aren't arbitrary, and they aren't sourced in pagan places. And therefore, according to the Ma'arik, they should be fine, because there's a real, clear, apparent reason. And Rav Shulti in this tshuva says, according to Ramat should be asar. He says, I think we should be machmir like the Vilna Gaon. I think we should be machmir like the Gra. And therefore, anything taken from non-Jewish sources, non-Jewish society, should be asar across the board, even if there is an apparent reason. And Rav Avadia, it's ironic, Rav Avadia, the Sephardi Pusik, says no. He says we should be mako like the Rama in all of these scenarios. And that's exactly what he does in the final lines of the Struva. He says, Alom Re'isi, Lididi Rav Gon Rav Baruch Jolti Shlita. They were friends. They were both living in Yerushalayim. It's hard to be too important a post game in Yerushalayim, not get to know each other. In his great article in the Kovetz Noam, which is a journal, about military funerals, and he wanted to be machmir. Rav Avadia says you could be makel. Unless you have a particular family minhag to follow the Vilna Gaon, then you should follow the Vilna Gaon, and all these things should be asar. Otherwise, it's going to be okay. That's how. Just like my previous tshuva, I have all these sources that say it's okay to be makel. And that's what Israel does nowadays. They have these ceremonies, they have these things. Every once in a while, it seems like somebody writes a tshuva saying it should be asur because of Hukas Akon. The response is always that standard psak is like the Rama. According to the Rama, based on the Marik, anything that has a good reason is going to be fine. Yeah, David, sorry.
So I'm just a little confused. First of all, according to the Rama, meaning it seems like in both directions you either have to be more machmir or more mekel. Because if you're going to say that these things, this style of funeral, for example, has a reason, you're showing up honor to the soldiers. If you still say that it's from Avodah Zarah sources. Well then, who's to say that shooting a rifle in the air is an honor? That's an idolatrous way of showing honor. So, meaning, you can get, it makes it too easy to get around it. You can say, well, we bring flowers to say that this is a way of showing honor. Anything, meaning, ways of showing honor and ways of commemorating are specific to the culture in which they arose. It's almost like you can't have both ways. On the other hand, it's odd to me that we're assuming that something that has non-Jewish sources has idolatrous sources. Aside from what you think of Christianity versus and Islam and Avodah Zarah, bracketing that whole machlokas, which is a whole separate can of worms, the fact that this style of funeral originated in Western armies. For all we know, there was a Jewish soldier in, I don't know, medieval, wherever, Western Europe who decided, meaning, there's no indication that any of these things are idolatrous, or even had idolatrous origins, even had Christian origins. They happen to have originated in a place where Christians also originated. But is that really enough? That seems like a stretch.
But I think your two questions answer each other. Meaning,
no, but I'm saying, but like, it seems like I can't. Like,
meaning, according to the Vilna Gaon, anything that's not Jewish, even if it's not idolatrous, is going to be off limits. So even if you have the single Jewish crusader, who maybe if that happens, it would be okay. But if you had a secular Christian, secular Americans, create a custom, according to the Vilna Gaon, it would be usur for Jews to copy.
Really?
According to the strict reading of the Vilna Gaon.
Why? Because
the Rambam doesn't mention anything about Avodah Zarah. This is non-Jews. So that was, we discussed that a bit last week.
Sorry.
If Akum means non-Ovdei Avodah Zarah, or any non-Jew, but the customs he's referring to are not religious or ritualistic customs. He's referring to Moses' dress, which he's almost explicit about, had nothing to do with religion, just fashion. Okay. And on the flip side, for the Rama, that's why all of these things are going to be okay, because we know, or we can assume, that anything that has a good reason doesn't have the sources in religion, in ritual. It was started because of that reason. Many military funerals were created in order to honor the fallen soldiers. Since there's a good reason there, we could assume that its practice, that its origin isn't idolatrous or isn't pagan. And therefore, anything that has a good reason, whose source is unknown, we could assume is fine.
It feels weird. I'm sure I can come up with things. I don't know the history of Mavodazar well enough, but it stands to reason somebody who's familiar with more history than I am come up with genuinely idolatrous practices that also have a good reason.
Exactly. And
so the fact that it has a good reason can't be evidence that it's not a Mavodazar.
No, so I think we're going to deal with cases like that in a second, but I think for the point, the issue is that if we don't know the source of the practice, and if there's a good reason, we have a reason to assume that it's not idolatrous. And that's what the Rama is basing himself off on. Yeah, you have it.
But there was also, wasn't there that, there was like a Gemara that even if like non-Jews do something, but we can find it in Tanakh or wherever, then and we can say, oh, this is similar to like what we already did before, then
right.
They do it. So just about the siren, isn't that sort of, not really clearly, but similar to like shofar?
Oh, interesting. You're saying that if you assume shofar isn't just a mitzvah, but it's there in Tanakh to signify something.
They've blown it during wars and all that kind of thing. To sort of
right. I guess the question then would be that if it's, is the purposes for shofar in Tanakh similar enough to honoring fallen soldiers that you use it as precedent? But if you could, then that would be another reason to be able. I honestly haven't gone through all of the literature about the sirens and military funerals, but it could be that idea mentioned somewhere. Okay, great. And that's more or less where things stand nowadays for the Rama and the Rama versus the Gra. The next case is a test case, is the case which David raised. Something has a good reason, and whose source is unknown, you can assume it's not idolatrous in origin. Let's say there's something that we knew for sure or originated in Christian ritual or in a pagan ritual, but there's a good reason for it, and we want to incorporate it into our lives for that reason, not for the religious aspects. So that mutar asar according to the Rama. It's going to be a relevant question. One possible example of this is something which we do every year, is flowers in the shul on Shavuos. Most shuls around the country decorate themselves with flowers, with trees, with grasses, for the holiday of Shavuos. And there are various reasons in the poskim as to why we do it. But historically, apparently, it originated, or at least it gained popularity, after the Christians began decorating their churches with flowers, trees, and other such things for whatever holidays they decorate their churches for. So, again, something is there for a reason. We want to decorate our shuls for shuls. We want to be mechavi the shul. We want to remember Har Sinai. We want to do something which has a purpose. But it gained popularity after it was incorporated into the Christian church. So is that going to be mutter or asur according to the Rama? Because on the one hand, it has non-Jewish religious overtones, but on the other hand, there is a toelis, there is a reason. So the Vilna Gaon tried to abolish this minhag. But he did it because he thought all kukos nakam should be asur. I mean, any non-Jewish practice should be asur. He said, especially this, because this has Christian overtones. This is what they do in Christian churches. So the question is, what should we do? We people who don't pass like the Vilna Gaon, passing like the Rama, and assume anything that has a positive reason is going to be mutter, unless it has non-Jewish, not just non-Jewish, but idolatrous origins. So here is something which has reason, but also has an idolatrous origin. So this question was asked both to Rav Moshe Feinstein and to Rav Avadia. So first let's deal with Rav Moshe Feinstein. It's the last tshuva, the last page. It's very short. The question was, what should we do, practically speaking? Should we put up these flowers in our shul? So Rav Moshe answered in a very short tshuva, by putting up these flowers and plants in your shul, if only go and said you shouldn't do it because Christians do it in their holiday, which is in the general proximity of Shavuos. First he quotes the Marsham, somebody. Marsham says, the granted Christians do it, but we don't care. We have our own reasons why we do it. We do it for a different to'alas, and therefore it's going to be fine. And then he says, another thing the Marsham said, the practices aren't identical. Non-Jews have trees everywhere. Jews only put their grasses and their trees and their plants inside the shul. So number one, we do it for a certain reason that's not Christian. And number two, the practices are not identical. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says, Eino klum, kedekasa kvo terasel. I don't like these reasons. And in this regard, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, we pass in like the Vilna Gaon. We don't pass in like the Vilna Gaon in general. Rav Moshe Feinstein makes that clear in other tshuvos. But in this regard, in this particular practice, we pass in like the Vilna Gaon, because here, he's pointing out that it gained popularity after the Christians began doing it. And therefore, even though it has a toelis, because its origins, in terms of popularity, are Christian, it's therefore going to be asur. And I don't know what they do at a Moshe Feinstein shul on the Lower East Side, but I assume they do not put up these things. You look at Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia Yosef was asked the same exact question. This is in Chavadas. Chavadas is his radio show. Meaning every Friday, back in the good old days, he used to have a radio show for like an hour. People would call in, ask some questions, they would just talk, they wrote them down afterwards, and they published them. It's pretty cool. So these tshuvas are usually shorter, because he was talking off the cuff. So somebody asked, what's up with this practice of putting up trees and plants and flowers and your shul on Shavuos? So first he goes through all the possible reasons. And then he says, in the bolded parts, the Chai Adam, who was the Dayan in Vilna at the same time that the Vilna Gaon was living there, Chai Adam recorded the Vilna Gaon told everybody in Vilna to stop putting up these flowers in their shul. And that's what the Gemara says in Sefer Ma'aserav. Look down to the third to last line. Ulam Rabino Yosef Kolon b'tshuvosav, but Rabino Yosef Kolon, the Ma'arik, in his tshuvos, kasav, if something doesn't have a reason, skip down one line. It sounds like we're copying them. Then you go with the second reason of the Marek. And then skip down to the next loaded part. I'm sorry, whenever everybody writes anything, it's usually very long, so it's hard to read through. Because we have our own reasons why we do it, even though Christians do the same thing, it's going to be perfectly fine. So it seems like here we have two different ways of reading this Ramah, of reading the Ma'arik. According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, anything that has Avodah Zarah overtones is going to be asur, even if we have our own reasons why we do it, and there are good logical reasons why we do it. According to Rabbi Avadia, as long as you could find the reason in the Medrash why it's okay, as long as you could source it in Jewish sources, even if it gained popularity after the Christians started doing it, it's still going to be okay because there is a Tam and a Toelis, there is an independent reason why we do it. We're not just doing it to copy the Christians. And you could theoretically come up with other scenarios where this is going to become an issue. Just to end off with one more issue, a very, very, very relevant issue, is I didn't even know this was a hot button issue until recently, but there are many poskim who are very against the practice of getting married inside a shul. Because if you look in the Ramah, you look in the Ashkenazi poskim about Hilchos marriages, there's a minhag to get married outside, under Kibas HaShemayim, get married under the stars. Christians got married in churches, and Jews got married outside. So when people started having fancy weddings, they wanted more formal weddings, or it was cold outside, or whatever it was, and they wanted to move weddings inside, and maybe have a little skylight, so there were many poskim who were very against having weddings inside shuls. They said it's kukasakum. But Chassam Sofer, living in the 1800s, apparently Rav Soloveitchik, living in the early to mid to late 1900s, were against the custom of having weddings inside shuls. Where the Rav apparently said there are two issues involved. Number one is kavod basic knesses. There's a certain kedusha in a shul that shouldn't be used for other purposes. Number two, they said it could be a violation of kukos hakum. There's a story in Nefesh HaRav that Rav Shakhtar records that the Rav used to not want to officiate at weddings that happened inside shuls. And one time, somebody didn't tell him, and they just drove him to the wedding, and it was inside a shul, so he officiated. He didn't want to not be inside a kedusha. But he told people afterwards that if he would have known that it was going to be inside a shul, he would have told the person to get a different Masada Kedushin. And there are many post-gim nowadays, if you look around, most post-gim are very mikro about this. Most post-gim assume that it's not an issue of kukos hakum, either because they disagree about the kukos hakum, or maybe after a century of Jews doing it, it's no longer an akum minhag, it's something that Jews do as well. And therefore nowadays, people get married in shuls all the time. But it was another issue, which is kukos hakum. Again, something that sort of has a logical basis to it. I mean, getting married in a shul is something, it's nice almost. Like you're there on the bima in front of the Aron Kodesh, you're getting married. But it was drawn from the Christian world, because Christians got married in churches, and therefore many poskim were very, very against it. Yeah, I think I'll turn it around. Thank you, guys.